Good morning. Now, I am in the process of undertaking something extremely significant and important in my life. And that is, I want to make sure that I know everybody's name, address, phone number, email address. I'm going to pass around this sheet, and quietly, slowly, during the course of this year, I want you to get your names clearly down over here. And I don't know what I'm going to do with it, because if we have to check attendance, you understand, it'll take half the year just to check attendance. But I even started it in my shul. There are a lot of people that are not members of the shul that daven in my shul in Harnov. And they don't know what's happening. I've been walking over every day to two or three people. You've been here for 20 years! And I don't know your name. And they smile, and they tell me their name, and I write it down. The important thing is I have to remember it, yes. I don't know. We go one step at a time. That would be a good idea. Huh? Yeah, when you were teaching, we were a little bit younger then, you know, and the gray cells were a little bit better. Yeah.
Now, we're starting with you.
Just pass it around. All right. Why am I upset? Because some of the most important notes for my shiur today, I left at home. I mean, what's up? No. It's a funny source sheet that you have, right? Good morning, everybody. It's a strange source sheet that you have in front of yourself. And I will explain what's going on over here. I'll explain by saying it last week was a bad week for Israel Finkelstein. I will explain everything. Last week was a bad week for Israel Finkelstein. Now, you're wondering, who is this Israel Finkelstein? Should I know Israel Finkelstein? Did I ever meet Israel Finkelstein? No, you don't have to know Israel Finkelstein. And I'm going to tell you all about him. I'll tell you all about him. Israel Finkelstein is one of the leaders of the minimalist school in this country. Now, don't get upset. I'm going to explain everything to you. There are two approaches to archaeology in this country. This is the most dug up country in the world. And there are two approaches. One approach is the maximalist approach. The maximalist approach is those who prove or attempt to prove by all sorts of archaeological digs around the country that whatever it says in Torah is true. The Bible is right. Then there's a minimalist view. And the high priest of the minimalist view is Israel Finkelstein of the University of Tel Aviv. And Israel Finkelstein believes in minimalism. The Torah is absolutely not true. It's myth. It's legend. It didn't happen. It didn't happen. Certainly, he says, there was no great kingdom here in the days of David or Solomon. I'm not even sure what he thinks about Avram Avinu. Did Avram exist or he didn't exist? There was nothing much going on over here. Nothing much going on over here. It was hundreds of years later. Hundreds of years. What are you talking about? Now, these issues erupt, I believe, every 10 years. How do I know that it's every 10 years? Because in 1999, there was a big explosion of an archaeological debate across the country, and a number of things happened. And it fascinated me so much that I clipped all the articles and I put them in a folder. The mess was, 10 years later, I found the folder. I knew where it was. When we get to it, I will read a few choice excerpts from that eruption of activity in 1999. But now it's already Mahalchen Kamat by 2009. It's 10 years later. And I have over here the headlines that appeared in the Jerusalem Post Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday of last week. First big zets to Finkelstein came on Wednesday. He was still reeling from that one, and it's another knockout on Thursday. The mensch is already, was Willman von Finkelstein. Comes Friday, and that wipes them out completely. Now I'll begin to explain. And you see, I have the articles, all the complete articles. Now I'll just have to remember what it said over there. But here, I just have a little bit of here. Wednesday, researchers place Edom copperworks on King Solomon timeline. According to Finkelstein, David and Solomon, if they existed, were so primitive. Copper mines down in the south. It's like saying the cavemen had copper mines. He said maybe there were 600 people living around Jerusalem. But a kingdom, 12 tribes, a temple in Jerusalem, that's fiction. Now all of a sudden, there are people who have tested the area around the mines, and with their carbon dating, wow, those mines date back to the biblical time of Solomon. Wow, Solomon, there were Solomon's mines. It's not simply something that was created by Hollywood. There were Solomon's mines. What set me going on Finkelstein, of course, is they interviewed him for the article on Wednesday, and Finkelstein said, do you understand what this means? This means rejecting 200 years of scholarly research. So I said to myself, and when Finkelstein and his gang started, did it occur to them, you know, you're trying to undo 3,500 years of Jewish history, Torah? No, that doesn't bother Finkelstein, old boy. But what bothers him is his verschlugene research. That's being called into question. And maybe it should be called into question. It seems that, let's see, do we have Finkelstein and others objected, however, noting that archaeological evidence in the nearby highlands of Edom show no evidence of habitation at the time, where the mines were. To answer these criticisms, Levy's team excavated to over 6 meters of slag near the center of the site, documenting the location of each bit of charcoal and other artifacts. The charcoal was then dated by physicist Thomas Higham of Oxford University, and it turns out, yeah, that around the copper mines, those copper mines, there was habitation, and there were people who lived there. And most important thing is what was found, a massive copper smelting plant in the biblical land of Edom, is at least 3 centuries older than researchers had believed previously. And if it's 3 centuries earlier, then it takes it into the timeline of the biblical King Solomon, the first ruler of United Israel 3 years ago. Researchers reported on Monday. The existence of the legendary king has been questioned by some scholars over the past 2 decades. because of the paucity of archaeological evidence supporting the biblical record. There isn't much archaeological evidence. I mean, it seems there's not enough archaeological evidence, you know, as of 2 decades ago. There may be new archaeological evidence today. But there is a paucity, a lack of archaeological evidence supporting the biblical record and the belief that there was no complex societies in Israel or Edom capable of building fortresses, monuments, and other complex public works such as large mines in the 10th century BCE. I like, there was one word that I liked in this article. I'm learning this article in the Jerusalem Post. Like we learn a Gemara or a Chanda. The article says the following. There's not enough archaeological evidence supporting the biblical record and the belief that there was no complex society at the time. It may be reduced to nothing scientific and no more than a belief. And that belief is being shattered. Thomas E. Levy of the University of California, San Diego. This is the most hotly debated period in biblical archaeology today. All right. So Finkelstein has made his comment that, you know, you want to question 200 years of archaeological work? Okay. So we go to Thursday. Thursday has First Temple Era Water Tunnel Uncovered in City of David Dig. Passageway might have been used in Israelites' conquest of Jerusalem. The fact is that I'm not going to do any justice to all the archaeological work that's going on in Ir David. Ir David is most probably one of the richest areas of archaeological knowledge that we have today, and it's just a place a kilometer or two away from here. And this First Temple Era water tunnel is extremely significant in terms of the conquest of Yerushalayim, the conquest of Ir David and Sion by David and his soldiers. And we may very well, that's on the second side of the sheet, don't look over there. If we're ready for it, then we'll deal with the whole story of the conquest of Yerushalayim, that, by the way, is very much interrelated with Avraham Avinu. Avraham Avinu and Yerushalayim are inextricably intertwined, but we'll leave that maybe later or next week. Gesundheit. All right. So now the Thursday is a water tunnel dating back to the First Temple era, but that might have been used even earlier during King David's conquest of Jerusalem, has been uncovered in the ancient city of David. So here, this is another swipe at Finkelstein. What, David? What conquest? It was nothing. David was nothing. Solomon was nothing. Jerusalem was nothing. All right? So Finkelstein got the works on Thursday. That was Wednesday, Thursday. Here I have Friday. Ceramic shard may bear oldest Hebrew inscription ever found. And that second headline, they, it became, it's a geworden Finkelstein schwarz vor die Augen. It became him black before the eyes when he took up, looked at this. Discovery could bolster case for accuracy of the Old Testament. The heroes, you understand, I feel like the Union Army is coming to rescue the biblical Old Testament. Our Torah, you understand, that we believe with perfect faith was given to us at Sinai, and every word in that Torah is MS, Moshe MS, the Torah's MS. Now, this discovery could bolster case for accuracy of the Old Testament. Anything that is accuracy of the Old Testament means a major blow to Izzy Finkelstein. Good old Finky from Tel Aviv. And the article, article says, by the way, you know where this ceramic shard was found? In the Elah Valley. You know what the Elah Valley was? The battle of David against Goliath was in the Elah Valley. An archaeologist digging at a hilltop southwest of Jerusalem believes a ceramic shard found in the ruins of an ancient town bears the oldest Hebrew inscription ever discovered. The five lines of faded characters written 3,000 years ago, and the ruins of the fortified settlement. Oh, they had settlements then too. Where they were found are indications that a powerful Jewish kingdom existed at the time of King David, says Yossi Garfinkel, the Hebrew University archaeologist in charge of the new dig at Hirbet Kelyafa. Do you understand what Finkelstein, how he shudders when he hears that there was a powerful Jewish kingdom at the time of King David? And here there's another quote over here that says the following. When I stand here, this is one of the good guys. When I stand here, I understand that I'm on the front lines of the battle between the Israelites and the Philistines, said Rabbi Barnea Levi Selivan, the group's director. I open my Bible and read about David and Goliath, and I understand that I'm in the biblical context. Now, I don't have the rest. There's a Finkelstein response over here that, like, Finkelstein made some kind of a snide comment about that this is a revival of this old idea that the Bible is true. A sort of snide remark like, come on, you know, we know that already. We know that the Bible is this and the Bible is that and David and Solomon are this or that. All right. Okay. What's it have to do with Parshas Lech Lecha? What does it all have to do with Parshas Lech Lecha? By the way, it was really very interesting, even if it had absolutely nothing to do with Parshas Lech Lecha. But another few quotes and we'll get to the... We're at the heart of what we want to talk about. 10 years ago, there was an article written in the Haaretz and very, very widely... Very widely distributed by a fellow called Zev Herzog. Zev Herzog basically says, this is what archaeologists have learned from their excavations in the land of Israel. You know what archaeologists have learned? The Israelites were never in Egypt, did not wander in the desert, did not conquer the land in a military campaign, and did not pass it on to the 12 tribes of Israel. Perhaps even harder to swallow is the fact, these are the words of Zev Herzog, which is described, what perhaps even harder to swallow is the fact, I love that, perhaps what's even harder to swallow is the fact, that the united monarchy of David and Solomon, which is described by the Bible as a regional power, was at most a small tribal kingdom. Zev Herzog is a colleague, chaver, a chavrusa of Finkelstein, and forget it. All of your young teivim and your shabbosses that are zechel itzias and tchaim, we were never in Egypt. Understand? Yahushua. Understand? Who was it that? What was her name? That Meretz lady? How did I forget her? Who? Not Greenfield. No, it was old. Shulamit Aloni. I nearly forgot Shulamit Aloni. So at least Shulamit Aloni said they shouldn't teach Yehoshua in the schools over here because Yehoshua was a conqueror. I don't want to say the rest of the things that she said. But okay, there's no problem because there was no conquest of Eretz Yisrael altogether. There was really nobody here to talk about. The main push, Behind archaeological research in Palestine was the country's relationship with the Holy Scriptures. And while, you understand, Goyim, Professor Albright of Johns Hopkins, was the great archaeologist who came here and did a tremendous amount of work, and the purpose of all of his work was to prove that everything that it says in the Bible is MS La'amito, it's all true. Archaeology assumed momentum with the activity of William Faxwell Albright, who mastered the archaeology, history, and linguistics of the land of Israel and the ancient Near East. Albright, an American whose father was a priest of Chilean descent, began excavating in Palestine in the 1920s. His declared approach was that archaeology was the principal scientific means to refute the critical claims against the historical veracity of the Bible stories, particularly those of the Wellhausen School in Germany. What he's referring to, the Wellhausen School in Germany, was a school of thought that it was biblical criticism, that Torah was not given at Sinai. It developed, it evolved over hundreds of years. In other words, that was the beginning of the main attempt to tear Torah apart bit by bit. And now he says he's coming here to Palestine and he's going to show that it's not so, and whatever it says in Torah is absolutely true. Albright believed that the Bible is a historical document, which, although it had gone through several editing stages, we don't believe that, but it's a historical document. He was convinced that if the ancient remains of Palestine were uncovered, they would furnish unequivocal proof of the historical truth of the events relating to the Jewish people in its land. I go through everything that he did. And then I don't have to read all of Herzog. It's a lot of fun to read it, especially in view of the three articles in the Jerusalem Post last week. This wipes Herzog out, and we haven't heard from him yet. But you know, Jews are not bad. Jews are very good. At the end of this long article attacking Torah, Jewish history, everything, he writes the following. This is just about the last paragraph. The archaeology of the land of Israel is completing a process that amounts to a scientific revolution in its field. You hear what he's writing 10 years ago? Completing now a scientific revolution in its field. It is ready to confront the findings of biblical scholarship and of ancient history. We're going to show those Albrights and those Moshes and those Rabbi Akivas and all of us. We're ready to confront them all. But at the same time, in other words, they say we have all the proof that Torah is not true. But at the same time, we are witnessing a fascinating phenomenon in which all this is simply ignored by the Israeli public. Here are the great revolutionary scientific findings, and it's ignored. Many of the findings mentioned here have been known for decades. The professional literature in the spheres of archaeology, Bible, and history of the Jewish people has addressed them in dozens of books and hundreds of articles. Even if not all the scholars accept the individual arguments that inform the examples I cited, the majority have adopted the main point. The majority of scholars say Torah just is not the historical record. There was no Jewish community in Egypt. There was no Exodus. Nothing but nothing. Nevertheless, these revolutionary views are not penetrating the public consciousness. About a year ago, my colleague, the historian Professor Nadav Ne'eman, published an article in the Culture and Literal section of Haaretz entitled, "To Remove the Bible from the Jewish Bookshelf." That was the title. But there was no public outcry. Well, I'm sure the Haaretz must have been upset. Maybe it means that people just don't read the Haaretz. I know for a fact that there are less people reading the Haaretz than ever before. I canceled my subscription 3 months ago. And at the end of the 3 months, it was last week, I get a call from the Haaretz. Do you want to renew the subscription? So I said, do you know? I've had a peaceful 3 months without your fashlugene paper. Why should I resume my subscription? And I turned it down flat. That was courage. That was heroism. All right? Now, any attempt, listen, Mika Amcha Yisrael. He writes, any attempt to question the reliability of the biblical description is perceived as an attempt to undermine our historic right to the land. In Yiddish, there's a beautiful expression. Du licht de hint bankobe, which translated is, here the dog lies buried. All of these pages and all of this stuff comes down to the bottom line. You know what it's all about? And he's going to say it clearly. It turns out, last paragraph, it turns out that part of Israeli society is ready to recognize the injustice that was done to the Arab inhabitants of the country, and is willing to accept the principle of equal rights for women, but is not up to adopting the archaeological facts that shatter the biblical myth. Shatter the biblical myth. The blow to the mythical foundations of the Israeli identity is apparently too threatening, and it is more convenient to turn a blind eye. Where lies the dog? They are undermining, indeed, our claim to Eretz Yisrael. You're telling us there was a temple on Har Habayit in the days of David and Solomon? What are you talking about? Myth, mythology, garbage. In other words, what's happening over here is, this is not pure science. There's a political agenda over here. There's a religious agenda too. I'm not bound by Torah. I'm not bound by Torah. I have no commitment to all of Jewish history. I'm a freier feigl, a free agent. There's a tremendous amount of anti-intellectualism in this great intellectual search for truth. You're phony! Precious Lech Lecha. Precious Lech Lecha. Yeah. One word. Move on, Mira. Okay, let's go. I bring the Mishnah in Avot. Famous Mishnah, Sorin Itzionos, Nisnas of Avram Avinu, all of us shalom. There were 10 tests that Avram Avinu had to undergo. God put him through 10 very difficult tests. Va'omad Bekulam. And he passed them all. Lahudia, in order to tell us, Kamachivato shel Avram Avinu Olam HaShalom, what profound love Avram Avinu of blessed memory had for God. The pshat at the perush on the Mishnah at the bottom says, Asorin Nisyonos Nitnaseh Avram Avinu Olam HaShalom Lefi HaRambam. We're going to go through the 10 Nisyonos according to the Rambam very quickly. Lech Lecha Mi'artzecha is the first. Lech Lecha Mi'artzecha, God comes to him in Ur Kasdim, someplace in Mesopotamia, and he says, pick up your roots, leave it all, and go to a land that I will show you. Doesn't even tell him what land. He comes to the land, next by Yehida Avaretz. He finally makes it to the promised land. He comes into the land. There's hunger in the land. He has to go down to Egypt. The third, the Lokach Sara LeBeis Paro. The third test that he has to undergo is that Sara is taken to the house of Paro. God had told him, by Lech Lecha, I'll take care of you, I'm going to watch you, everything's going to be okay. What are you talking about okay? They're in a foreign land now. the mightiest power of the ancient world, and they've taken Sarah to the house of Paro. Milchamtonio avarat hamalachim. The next one was he wages war with the four great kings, and we talked about that a few weeks ago. You understand? His nephew is being held by a bunch of Rishayim. He doesn't remain silent. He risks his life to go out there and get him back. Of insgesucht that we should have that kind of courage and determination to bring back a Gilad Shalit. Bekachtoet Hagal le'isha la'acha shenoash meholit misara. The Rambam says when he had to take Hagar because he had lost hope that he would have any children from Sarah. That was a big nisoyin. You know what the nisoyin is? Because God has entered into a covenant in him. At the beginning of Lech Lecha, he tells him, Lechol l'zarecha, to you and your children, I'm going to give this land. Children, vos chetzi, you're going to give Eretz Yisrael to my children. There are no children. Huh? Well, he told him to take Sarah and come to Eretz Yisrael. That's the first couple. Hagar is not part of the equation. She was never part of the equation. By the way, she isn't part of the equation today either. And the fact that he cannot have children with his beloved wife, what do you think? Well, women are mothers? No. This was a big Nisayan. That he has to give up hope on having a child from Sarah. This is a powerful blow to our form of him. Hamilosh and Itstavu Babi made Azikin at his old age. He's commanded to go through the process of circumcision. And then all of those are in Parshat Lech Lecha. In Parshat Veda, we have Lekichat Sora Lebeit Abimelech, Sora being taken to the house of Abimelech. Girush Hagar. When he has to cast out Hagar and Ishmael. And it says he was very upset until God appeared to him and he told him, Kol asher tomar elech or Sarah shma b'kol or whatever Sarah says to you, listen to her. Har kokas b'no Yishmael. That included not only casting out Hagar, but sending away his son Yishmael. Yishmael was his son. A father has feelings for a son. Number 10 is Akidat Yitzchak. We don't have to talk about that. I asked years ago, and I'm coming back to it now, but we're going to take, a variation on the thing. Avraham Avinu, the Rambam describes him as the one single individual in a world that had fallen into pagan and heathen practices, had forgotten God. Avraham was raised in a community, in a culture, in a society, in a family, in a town, where everybody worshipped idols, and he worshipped idols with them, the Rambam says. But he was troubled, and then, while yet in his youth, began the great emotional and intellectual turmoil in the mind of this little Avraham, that he begins to question and to doubt what everybody around him is doing. For years, he thinks, he ponders, he meditates, he suffered, he's tortured, he gets up in the middle of the night in a cold sweat. When he begins to realize that maybe everybody around him is making a tragic, tragic mistake, an idea begins to develop in his mind of an invisible God who had created everything, and all of that they're doing is nonsense, absolute nonsense. Rambam goes on to describe how when he finally arrived at that revolutionary conclusion, and it was difficult for him because it required of him to say that the whole world is crazy and he's the only sane one in a world gone mad. It's not easy to do that. It's much easier to say that, you know, if everybody's doing it, you know, everybody's doing it, then it's obviously good. Maybe there's something I don't understand. Maybe I'm not so smart. But no, he arrives at the conclusion that there is a God, an invisible God, who created the world. And the world is making a terrible mistake. He also arrives at a conclusion that he understands where the mistake began. Somewhere back there, when somebody decided that since God created the whole world and he created the sun, then you know we should show a little respect to the sun. S-O-N. I didn't mean the Father and the Son. I meant the God Almighty. S-U-N. 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 Whatever. You talk about Son of God, you know, you got to be careful what you're talking about. No, I'm talking about the S-U-N. Right, okay. You see, you understand me anyway. I can make mistakes and you understand me. All right. And he realized that this is how it all developed. And then there were those who said, let's show some kind of appreciation for the moon and nature. And then with the passage of time, that's where it always is. Everything was forgotten. And Avraham makes an even bolder step than his discovery. He decides that he must share his discovery with the whole world. And that's going to place him in grave danger, which it in fact did, because you can't stand up and challenge and confront a whole world and expect to get away with it unscathed and unharmed. And he does it, and he does it. And Ad Hayom Hazeh, 4,000 years later, a world is indebted to the greatness of an Avraham Avinu. Avraham has risked his life every day for I don't know how many decades. Why does God have to test him? Why in heaven's name does God have to test Avraham with 10 tests? Not one, not two, not five, 10. Hashias Amecho, Barichas Nachlasecha. You can count the 10 for a minion if you can say the 10 Nisyonos of Avraham quickly enough. Why is he tested? This is a man who has discovered, he's found God. One of the most brilliant people, if not the most brilliant of all of history. Why does he have to suffer time and time again? It's only at the end, after the Akedah, God finally says to him, Ato Yodati, now I know, Ki Yirei Elokim Ata, that you are God-fearing. Can you imagine that? Yitzchak is not going to be tested. Yaakov is not going to be tested. They're going to go through all sorts of trials and tribulations in life, but they're not being specifically tested by God. The approach that we have to take over here is the following. There are two ways by which we achieve the knowledge of God. One is by intellect, by mind, by thought, by investigation, by seeking, by searching. Then there's another way. You know what the other way is? Ani ma'amin be'emunah shleima, I believe with absolute faith that there is a God and he created everything and he gave us Torah and he sent Moshe. He rewards and he punishes. He will soon bring the Mashiach. I believe. Yes. Emunah. Faith. There's inquiry. There's mind. There's intellect. And then there's that's right, Emunah. Now, there's a difference between the two. There's a difference between the two. Each one has advantages and disadvantages. The advantage of faith is, faith does not begin with a question. Does God exist? Doesn't exist. All intellectual inquiry has to begin with an open mind. Is there a God? Isn't there a God? Then you start gathering the evidence. Understand? You gather evidence. And of the evidence, some is going to be in favor of the existence of God. Some is going to be opposed to the existence of God. And you have to weigh and measure. And it's not only a matter of, well, I have 10 reasons that seem to indicate that God exists, and I have 7 that God doesn't exist. That's not enough. You have to take a look at the relative strength. It could be that the 7 reasons that he doesn't exist can be stronger, more powerful, more convincing than the 10 that say he does exist. I mean, this is a tortuous, that's what I called it, a very tortuous process. Emunah, faith, no questions asked. What are you talking about? My tata told me, and my Zayda told him, going back all the way, you know, to who? To Avraham Avinu. What are you talking about? We believe us. That's the Jews have faith. Jews have faith. They have faith that there's a God, and they have faith that Torah is true, and that's why they didn't get shook up by Zev Herzog's assault on Torah. Found on a chapa. Boy, I'd love to know how he, what happened to him after he read the three articles in the Jerusalem Post. His whole world is crumbling around him. So there's an advantage to faith. The advantage to faith is it begins with no questions. Then again, there's something about faith that this not so advantageous. It doesn't necessarily excite somebody. You don't get up in the morning and say, "Ah, what a beautiful day! I believe." But what happens if you've been through a long night thinking about the existence of God, and at the dawn's early light, I discovered God. That's exciting. That's exhilarating. Then again, faith has an advantage. It's tried, it's tested, it's proven. Millions upon millions of Jews, maybe without number, went to their death throughout all history, like Rabbi Akiva did, saying, Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. Powerful. The strength of faith is powerful. Then on the other hand, and this is the point we want to get to, how solid and how firm is an intellectual decision? I arrived at an intellectual decision about something. In this case, it's the existence of God. What is the meaning of arriving at that kind of a decision? The meaning of that decision is that at this moment, with all of the evidence that is available to me now, and the way I feel, I had a good night's sleep, looks okay to me, this God business is okay. Is there any guarantee that this may not change in the future? What kind of guarantee is there? It may be possible that a few years from now, I'm going to think of something that I didn't take that into consideration. I have to reopen the case all over again. Let's take a look. How many reasons do I have pro-God? How many reasons do I have con-God? I made a decision without having known this, and now it starts all over again. The rule in science and in intellectual inquiry is that whatever decision one arrives at, it's always tentative. It always means on the basis of what I know right now, such and such is the truth. Never, ever any guarantee that it may not change dramatically and drastically. Let's use our example of today. If Finkelstein and Herzog would be honest scientists, if they would be honest scientists, then all they could have said 10 years ago is that on the basis of the information that we have now, there was no Egypt, and there was no David, and there was no Solomon, and there was no Garnish. But they have to be intellectually honest and leave open the, you know, there may be new information, and I'll have to reopen it. So now, you know what they got on Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday? Triple header, you understand? They get one piece of information, a second piece of information, a third piece of information that shakes their previous theory. If they would be truly intellectuals who search for truth and truth alone, then they would have reacted to each one of these. My, this is very important. We're going to have to take a look at this and see. You know, my decision that I made 10 years ago may have been a mistake. I mean, there is new evidence now, and the new evidence. But no! What's his response? You know what his response is? He's the intellectual whose intellectual belief that what he decided is true, it's become faith. He's not an intellectual anymore. An imam in Bemuna Shlema in the shtuyot that I decided on. You know what we call that? That's not science. There's something that is called scientism. When science becomes a religion, and whatever I decided on is Kodesh Kadoshim, Holy of Holies, that means he's closed his mind completely. He's not open to anything else. He doesn't want to be open to anything else. We have it not only in the field of religion and in the field of science. We have it in politics as well. There is so much that has happened over the last 15 years that should have straightened out all the kumet kep. I don't know, I must have gotten up speaking Yiddish this morning. Something that should have straightened out all the crooked minds. And it doesn't happen. There's a beautiful, beautiful piece. I don't know if I'm going to be able to do real justice to it. But I, after 20, 30 years, I went back to it again yesterday. Every word, Tafman Oiskishen, it's in a sefer that was written by Rav Elimelech Bar Shaul, the Rav of Rehovot. He passed away at a very young age. I think it was 52. That was a long time ago. And he left a legacy of a number of Sfarim. And one of them, he talks about the difference between faith and intellect. And because of him, I found... Wait, here it is. It's got to be here. You know, I didn't leave everything at home. Or did I? He says there's a very big difference between knowledge that I have as a result of faith and that which I have as a result of intellectual inquiry. He says that in the world of science, you can never arrive at an absolute judgment. We were using the term that science is always tentative, it's on the way. So he says, in all areas of intellect, the most that we can achieve is a decision. So I had to take a look. I pulled out my thesaurus. That was another one of the miracles of the early hours of this morning. I found my thesaurus. I'm not like one of these chachomim that can do it in seconds on the computer. Decide to settle. To settle, to resolve, to arbitrate—that doesn't really mean that I've accomplished something hard and fast. It means, you know, I have two possibilities, and from amongst those two possibilities, I have to make a choice. So the thesaurus says about choice, an option. Well, a very timely word comes next. Election. Election. Right? Anybody who hears this tape should know that today is election day in the United States of America, or in a few hours it's going to be election day in the United States of America, and we're very concerned here in Eretz Israel. Choice? Selection? Preference? Does that sound like something very, very solid? Not solid at all. Alternative. Option. Rav Elimelech Bar Shaul says that any decision that one arrives through at intellectually is never more than that. I made a decision. I had two options. I chose one of the options. Does it mean that that option is necessarily absolute truth? No, no, not at all. Truth, the thesaurus says, is reality, existence, authenticity, truthfulness, faithfulness. What a nice word to use for truth. Faithfulness, constancy, steadfastness, trustiness, loyalty, fealty. What I decide upon as a result of my intellectual inquiry is nothing more than having chosen an option, one of two. Do I know how long I will indeed believe that that option is the correct one? Not a chance in the world. Tomorrow there will be new information. What are you talking about? Tomorrow, researchers are going to place Edom copper works on King Solomon's timeline. Tomorrow you're going to find the first temple tunnel, you understand, which proves that psukim, fascinating psukim in Tanakh, both in Shmuel and in Divrei Hayomim, there may be a tremendous amount of truth to it. And that ceramic shard over there in the valley of Elah, where you see David and Goliath fighting with one another, it's sort of like talking from the past. If so, the Rebbeinu Shlom now turns to Avram. He doesn't say it to him. Avram's intellectual decision has got to be tested. When we say it has to be tested, does it mean God doesn't know whether he's going to pass the test? Of course not. Of course not. God knows exactly how he's going to pass the test. You know who doesn't know how he's going to pass the test? Avram doesn't know how he's going to pass the test. And you know what's going to happen with each test that Avram passes? He's going to begin to evolve from the man of intellect to a far, far higher and a greater man, to the lonely man of faith. That's what's going to happen to him. Every test, as he undergoes it, Avram Avinu is going to become a man of faith, because you know what's true about all of the 10 tests that he undergoes? There's one common denominator. They're all ridiculous. They're illogical. They make no sense. God Almighty, Avram could have said, do you know what I have going on over here in Mesopotamia? There are tens of thousands who are following me. Now you tell me, drop this all, leave, go off to some other land and start all over again. What's wrong? And what, do you know what you're telling me? You're trying to tell me, God, that there is some little speck on the face of this earth where you can't even get the name on the map, yeah, that you are there more than you are any place else. Do you know? That shatters my whole belief. Who did I discover? I discovered the God of the whole cosmos. I discovered the God that created everything. Now you're going to tell me that you're more in that little place than anywhere else on the face of this earth? This is a blow to the intellectual mind of Avram. But you know what he does? He goes. Lech lecha me'aretzcha mimoladetcha, go from your land el haaretz, to the land asher ar'eka. You know what that ar'eka really means? Not the land that I'm going to show you. The land that I'm going to show you what you really are. Ar'eka. You think you're the great intellect now? Avram, you've got a big surprise coming. You're going to become one of the great believers. You're moving up into a completely different category. Everyone, do we have to talk about the Akedah being anti-logical? a blow to everything he believes in. He's going to take a life, and he's going to take the life of his own son. The son whom God promised him is going to be the father of a Jewish people. Can there be anything more absurd? But he does it. Every one of them. What do you mean? I'm going to have children. I understood I'm going to have children with my wife, Sarah. What do you mean? No, she can't have children. Oh, I have to marry Hagar. So now you tell me I'm marrying Hagar. Now I have Ishmael. Now I have to throw them out. You told me to take care. You sent me to this land, Canaan. I gave everything up and I went to Canaan. And I come there. There's a famine in the land. This is where you sent me. There's not all 10 tests that Avraham Avinu undergo are illogical. Now a man who's a great intellect, listen to this. We always have to be concerned about the great intellectual. Is it his discovery that motivates him and moves him? Or is this great intellectual one who is really serving not the God whom he discovered? You know what he's really serving? Himself. I discovered you, God. You know what? You know who he's serving and worshipping? His own brilliance, his own self. And he has never become fully, he will never become fully under the greatness of a God. I saw the example once, I don't remember where now, I thought it was here. Man, great scientist who created the atom bomb, is standing in a room with the bomb. He, more than anybody else in the world, knows the awesome destructive power of that bomb. He'll look at it, he'll stand there in awe, in overwhelmed. He'll never be able to prostrate himself before that bomb. Bamala, I discovered you. You didn't discover me. What is the God that Avraham has discovered? Is the God that Avraham has discovered Avraham's own brilliance to which he serves? Oh no, he has discovered a God. And do you know what he discovers together with that God? Lo levado ra'ui lehitpalel, only to him and to him alone should man pray and prostrate himself before that God. Do you know when he's going to realize the extent of his great discovery? When he's going to undergo 10 tests. Avram's 10 tests are going to remove all of the weaknesses of intellectual decisions. And he now throws himself completely under God. Ato yodati, now I know, ki yirei elokim ato. Yitzchak will not have to undergo any tests. Yaakov will not have to undergo any tests. Why? It's all summed up in my one great pasuk that I have used on so many occasions in so many different ways. Jewish people at the sea exclaim, Zekeli van Veyu el Keyavi Varomenu, this is my God, and I will exalt him, the God of my fathers, and I will uplift him. If they see God, Rashi says they saw God. Why do they have to say, El Keyavi, the God of my father? In their own experience, they've experienced God now. Rashi says, when they said, El Keyavi, the God of my father, they said, Lo ani tchilas hakedusha, I'm not the beginning of this sanctity. El muhzeket vaomedet li kedusha tov elokuto alai mi meyavotai. His sanctity and his divinity is something that I have with me from the days of my fathers. You know what they're saying? Zekeli van Veyu represents my intellectual experience. I experienced God. Not good enough. And the only reason they were able to see God is because he's Elokei Avi, the God of my father, and I will exalt him. Do I have to throw in my old Marshall McLuhan? Marshall McLuhan, I wouldn't have seen it if I hadn't believed it. I wouldn't have seen it if I hadn't believed it. Klal Yisrael by the Yam Suf is saying, do you know why we were able to say Zekeli van Veil? because we already knew that there's a Rebbeinu Shel Olam from Avram, Yitzchak, Yankiv, all the way back. So the story of Lech Lecha and Vayecha is the transformation of Avram Avinu from a man of great, awesome intellect to an infinitely far greater man who is able to say, Ani Mamin B'Emunah Shleima.